Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am delighted to be joined today by Andy Gosler, Professor of Ethno-Ornithology at the University of Oxford and an ordained minister in the Church of England. He shares some of his fascinating story in this great new book, Coming to Faith Through Dawkins. Andy, many people would suggest that Christianity and evolution are not compatible. What would your response be to that?
The God who is the ground of all being, who is the God of love, who is the God who we find through prayer and scripture and our own experience and through tradition. But as I say, that wasn't my tradition when I found faith, is the same God who upholds and sustains all of existence, which operates through what we perceive as the scientific principles. So if I go back to the concept of the image of God, so go back to Genesis and this idea of the Imago Dei, that you're created in the image of God. What does that mean? Does it mean that God looks like me, or I look like God? But, you know, there are billions of people on this planet and we all look different. So which one does God? No, don't go there. That's not what it means. What is the image of God? And the image of God that I think most resonates with this sense for me is bringing order out of chaos. From you see it actually in the beautiful words of Genesis chapter 1. You know, God moves over the waters, you know, the waters being kind of chaotic. So there's an image of chaos, and out of that chaos comes order. And what is the most ordered thing we can think of? Well, it's not artificial intelligence. It is real intelligence. It's life, the way that cells operate, the physiology. It's incomprehensibly beautiful and wonderful. With a more nuanced understanding of God and a more accurate understanding of biology, and we are getting that now, the resonance between the two is, you know, I spend a lot of time when Genesis talks about in creation that, you know, each day he says, and it was good, he saw that it was good. And I think, how would I define good from this? If that gives me a sense of what good looks like, what is it that is there that is good? And I can focus on, yes, this sense of bringing order out of chaos, and the fact that it all works so amazingly together, and the complexity of ecology and with feedbacks and Gaia and all the rest of it, just absolutely amazing. But for a long time, I like to think, well, what I understand as good and therefore evil is that what is good is life affirming. And evil is what denies the affirmation of life. And I found that the finding that resonance between the science, which is, you know, has been described as thinking God's thoughts after him, you know, that finding that resonance between our biblical understanding, a nuanced understanding, a nuanced theology, a modern theology, and a modern biology is itself life-affirming. Because what creates, you know, like when I was a child, what creates anxiety and a lack of peace is conflict, conflicts of ideas. And nobody can live with the idea, well, there's the scientific truth and there's this biblical truth and they're both true, and but I don't know how to meld them. And so the only way I can live with that is to either put them in separate boxes and be a Christian on a Sunday and the rest of the time I do science. Well, that's no way, you know, or to just totally reject one or the other. Reject religion, be a scientist. Reject science and think you're being a Christian. But you're not being a better Christian by denying the creation that is God's gift to everything. and so find that way. You know, Jesus appeared after the resurrection. He appeared to the disciples in the upper room, and his first words to them were, "Peace be with you." His very first words. I mean, they were terrified. They thought, "Whoa, we saw you die," you know, and here he is, and he says, "Peace, peace," you know, and so that's the thing. We need to find the peace. And. And understanding that this is not a clarion call for every Christian to be a molecular biologist or for every molecular biologist to be a Christian, but to understand that actually these are beautifully resonating aspects of reality. And you'll find peace for yourself if you can understand that.
I suppose some of what we were talking earlier about the limitations of the neo-Darwinian framework of natural selection, that might be partly why some Christians think that perhaps evolution isn't compatible with the account in Genesis, for example, because of that kind of, you know, what Dawkins says about nature being red in tooth and claw and survival of the fittest. And, you know, in some ways, that's totally antithetical to God and wanting to look after everyone else and put God first and not ourselves first. Would you say that actually when we get a better view of the scientific, the correct view of evolution, that actually it is easier to reconcile that with the Christian perspective?
Yes, definitely. So a few things to say about the literal reading of Genesis. We have a word in theology called exegesis, which basically says, you know, approach every text, every biblical text, every text of scripture with an exegetical frame of mind, which says, don't worry so much about the exact wording. Because for one thing, it wasn't written in your language and you're reading it in a translation. And which translation are you reading? Don't worry about that. Search for the meaning. What is the meaning of this text? And so much of the literalist argument that I hear about Genesis, which of course conflicts with a scientific narrative because it's not an exegetical, it's worrying about the commas. Well, I'm sorry, it wasn't written with commas, not in the Hebrew. So, you know, what are you talking about? You know, that's not the spirit of that text. It's absolutely beautiful allegorical narrative. And the fact that it's allegory does not make it less important. It makes it more important because the relationships that it describes between us and the rest of creation and with God is absolutely critical to our well-being. And what does it say? With an evolutionary understanding of the tree of life, that is the seven branched, you know, lampstand of Exodus, which is a symbolic presentation depiction. The menorah is the word I'm just thinking about. the menorah. The menorah is the symbolic representation of this symbolic text. And, you know, the two come from the same sort of time. So you've got these 7 days and you've got this image of creation of the menorah. The sense that the same hand created all these plants and animals and everything else, and also created us, and incidentally on the same day as the creepy crawlies and the cattle. Put that with an evolutionary perspective, and incidentally use a Franciscan perspective to bolt the two together, because St. Francis recognized all of life as kin. Now, you know, he even to the extent of you know, it's our little sisters, the birds, but actually, you know, he uses the language of kinship even for the sun and the moon, you know, brother sun and sister moon. Everything is brothers and sisters, which is the language of kinship. And we use the language of kinship, you know, religiously when we talk about God as Father. The evolutionary perspective underpins that, or I shouldn't say underpins it, I'd say affirms it. The sense that I have evolved from millions and millions, maybe billions of generations of life, that all my ancestors, I can find kinship with a banana because I share genes, or the evidence is that I share genes with them. But actually, at some point in the history of life, going back billions of years, at some point we shared a common ancestor. Now, that is science totally in agreement with St. Francis's understanding of all life as kinship, which is represented in the menorah and in the meaning of Genesis 1, is that you are kin with those creepy crawlies and the cattle. And that's reflected. The days of creation, you hear all sorts of things. Oh, well, maybe a day represents so many millions of years. Yeah, maybe it does, but no, I don't think it does. I think this is a rhetorical, you know, framing to tell you this took time. And don't get hung up on whether it was literally a day or it was 24 hours. Oh, well, days were longer in those. No. They weren't actually, they were shorter because the moon was closer to the earth and a day was actually shorter millions of years ago. So that doesn't help you. So no, don't go there. We, you know, Christians have understood since the time of Origen, you know, first century Roman Christian theologian who read Genesis and said, well, this is obviously he didn't use the word allegorical, but you know that's the thing. He said, I can't remember the exact word he used, but you know, figurative. That's it. He said this is obviously figurative language. It's not, you know, it's more poetry and metaphor. And if we deny the importance of metaphor in faith, then we've got to deny all the parables, because it's exactly the rhetorical method that Jesus used to teach. He taught people by asking questions. I was reading, there's a book I learned about recently, about the 307 questions that Jesus asked, and he only answered three. He lets you answer them for yourself, you know. And that's the spirit of engagement with these beautiful, beautiful texts. And to reduce it to literal readings is actually to take the spirit out of it and to reduce it to, you know, the phone book or something.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God Apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
Well, Andy, you've definitely covered this already, touched on it a little bit. But if someone was to say to you, I couldn't even begin to think about believing in God because I'm a scientist, because there is this fundamental conflict, how would you, as a Christian scientist, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, I have to be careful with the words Christian scientist, don't you?
But, oh, sure, of course. Yes, you are a Christian and a scientist.
A scientist who is a Christian.
That's a helpful clarification, well, thank you.
Okay, so we've debunked the myth that science and Christian faith are incompatible, and we must keep on debunking that. So any Christian who says, I can't believe in God because I'm a scientist, you say, well, okay, let's talk. You have your own reasons for not believing in God, and they may be the same as mine. Most atheists who, and they're always very, very quick to tell me, especially where the collar, they say, well, I don't actually believe anything myself, but... I had this experience, or, you know, whatever. Okay, fine. Whereas I don't generally find Christians running around the place saying, hey, I'm a Christian, you know, but the atheists are always very quick to tell you whether you're wearing the collar or not. Another point. But people have their own reasons, and it has to do with fear. Which is a kind of Genesis theme. It has to do with, yeah, maybe they're running away from a bad religious experience. You know, like my experience as a child, where, as I say, God said to me, or how I paraphrase it now, is saying, yes, Andy, that's religion done with. Now come and find me. And there is no greater invitation, and there is no more important thing that any human being can do, because that is the gift to us. The gift of being human is the ability to actually connect psychologically to the intelligence, the wisdom, the the love that is the ground of this creation. We cannot, we can live in this universe and just ask questions about it. But at the end of the day, the issue of whether you seek God or not is not a scientific issue. And it's not a professional issue. And it has nothing to do with your academic credibility or your scientific credibility, unless there is a culture within your science of saying, well, that's a problem. And of course, there is, has been that culture in biology. But cultures change, and cultures can change very more easily and more quickly, than a Darwinian evolution, snail's pace of things. Cultures can shift in a heartbeat. The fact that 20 years ago, I went to an Arusha gathering. It was a celebration, I think, of 20 years of Arusha UK, which is a Christian conservation organization. And the children who were the kids of Arusha, the children of the people who worked for Arusha, got up on the stage and they sang this song, which went, "Ah, God's wicked." Now, to a person of my age, to be told
that's not a good
by
thing.
A Christian child that our God's wicked is like, whoa, okay, that's a culture shift, isn't it? Because the word wicked has completely changed, and so cultures can change in a heartbeat, and the young people drive changes in the culture, changes in words, you know, and older people like me have to, I nearly said like us, I'm sorry, with older people like me, you know, have to work out that lol means laugh out loud, and it's okay. And they probably don't use that anymore because that was like yesterday's word, but whatever, in a text. So this thing of I couldn't believe, no, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But you're a human being, and therefore somewhere in you is a desire to search, not just to know whether it's true, like some academic thing, let's tick that box, but no, because when you make that connection, you'll find that God works with you in the most gracious and beautiful way, and it is life-changing. Of course it's life-changing, and of course you discover that it's true as well, and it can guide your science and academic understanding as well.
Andy, you are an ethno-ornithologist, but you are also a priest in the Church of England. How did that come about?
So the call, it is vocation, it is the origin of the word vocation, is a sense of calling. And I kind of discovered that I was having experiences that not everyone around me in church was having. And I got to sort of thinking a bit, why is this? What is God saying to me? And through a slightly convoluted path, so I preached once, and it was about nature, conservation, faith. And the bishop got to read my sermon. This was Bishop John. And I think I was a church warden by that point, and so I met him at some gathering. And he said, I read your sermon. It's very good. You should preach more often. And I was at a diocesan synod where we had a little talk about, you know, it's fine for people to preach from time to time, but if they're going to do it frequently, they should get a license. So I talked to my vicar about a license to preach, and he said, well, actually, Andy, I think you should be considering lay ministry. And eventually I got sort of sent off to a couple of people to talk about the vocations advisor, actually, in the deanery, who said to me, Andy, why lay ministry, not ordained? And, you know, a little voice in the back of my head is saying, hey, this is getting a bit out of hand here. You know, I just wanted a license to preach from time to time. And you know, and people are seeing something in me. And I was sent off to talk to Diocesan Director of Ordinance, DDO, who expressed it quite interestingly as the difference between lay ministry and ordained ministry as a sense of the difference between what you do and what you are. And I know that's a slightly problematic framing of it, but it did make sense to me. And, you know, it spoke very powerfully about, you know, and this sense of identity that was coming through that is that, well, maybe I am actually being called to priestly ministry. So then I was put in touch with my own DDO, Raymond, and went to the, you know, bishop's advisory panel, and well, we went through that without any kind of problems, and it is a sense that I got very, I've had all, throughout my life, actually, that actually, if you're doing the thing that you're called to do, the doors fly open. And if you're not doing, you know, then they don't. And the doors were flying open. And there is a resonance, actually, between ethno-ornithology because priestly ministry, because the connection that people find with nature, and especially through birds, but not only through birds, the connection that people find through nature, of course, is the connection people find with God. It's a very well-trodden route to finding God through nature. But having used that language, I don't actually believe that people find God. I believe that people allow God to find them. Because we put up all these barriers to, I couldn't believe. Why couldn't you believe? Well, because my own street cred as a this, that, the other, you know, what others will think of me might be harmed. And there has to come a point where you say, to hell with that. That doesn't matter. I'm talking about my real identity and my connection, my real connection to the heart of this thing that I'm passionate about, with it, which is nature and life and, you know, having a sustainable future.
Andy, you've definitely touched on this throughout the show. And just as we end, I'd love to know, you must have, throughout your career, but also personal connections, been surrounded by atheists, agnostics, people who perhaps don't know what to believe, people of other faiths. Why do you, Professor Andrew Gosler, believe in God?
Because I have found the truth of the teaching that the heart of existence, the heart of reality, the heart of what we religiously call creation, is love. And I've discovered that God does love all his creation, even me. And people have said to me, one of the many grounds for their atheism, people have said to me, I couldn't possibly believe that a God who created all of this, when I look at the universe, and it's billions of years. And I look back to the oldest light reaching the Earth, and it's 13 or 14 billion years old. And the size of the universe, and I'm this tiny little thing on this tiny little rock, on this tiny, you know, this tiny little solar system, blah, 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 one of billions of galaxies, billions of stars in billions of galaxies. I cannot believe that the God who created and sustains all of this should care about me. That just seems untenable, which is a kind of humility. And humility is good. Humility is the most precious thing for a disciple. But I spin that. I would spin that and say, what is so special about you that God shouldn't? I can't believe that the God who sustains the whole of creation should care about me. My answer is, what is so special about you that he shouldn't? Because I found that to be true.
Andy, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. And I will make sure that there are links in with today's show so that people can find out more about you, about the work that you're doing, about your ministry. But thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. An absolute pleasure.
As always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources, and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.